The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Ireland's call, should we deploy the army to an understaffed airport? Must try harder, was the minister right to name and shame four schools? And talking shop, is there anything to be said for another debate on the housing crisis? We'll have all of that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, we have Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Fine Gael and party spokesperson on climate action. Rose Conway Walsh, Sinn Féin TD for Mayo and spokesperson on higher and further education, research, innovation and science. Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central and spokesperson on education, higher education, arts, social protection, foreign affairs and defence. And Adam Higgins, political correspondent with the Irish Sun. We want to hear from you as well, so do get in touch. Text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @latedebate_rte. Now, the government has agreed to a request from the Minister for Transport, Eamon Ryan, for the army to be on standby to help with security at Dublin Airport. Adam, sure, it's only a few weeks ago since they completely dismissed this as a mad idea of Michael O'Leary's, right?
You're right, yeah, this is a big U-turn from the government. We've previously seen Minister Coveney and the Taoiseach out saying that they didn't want the Defence Forces to be coming in to help the DAA. But Minister Ryan has asked the Cabinet today for approval to prepare the troops, basically, to go out and help the DAA. So this is going to be on a precautionary measure. So about 100 soldiers, is what we're told, will be kind of put on standby in case they're needed in security positions within Dublin Airport. So it's what we're told is it's not going to be passenger-facing positions, and it's not going to be positions in behind on air side. This is going to be basically where staff are getting their badges checked and that sort of stuff. So it's security jobs that will free up other personnel. The soldiers then that will be paid by the DAA, their allowance will be paid by the DAA. So that's an allowance called the Aid to Civil Authority allowance. From what we can understand, it's about €50 per day per shift in the middle of the week, and it goes up a little bit then on Saturday and Sunday, 70 on a Saturday and 100 on a Sunday. So Defence Forces are on standby. We don't know whether they're going to be called in. By all the soundings from the DAA today, it looks like they won't need them, but I mean, they've made this call for a particular reason, and it's really put the government in an awkward position because they didn't want to do this.
They're not that happy about it, are they? The representative bodies, RACO, were out today.
No, in particular, yes, RACO put out a very strong statement saying that they were quite critical of the government's move to bring the Defence Forces in to help the DAA. From a worker's perspective, and I spoke to a number of soldiers before coming on today, just rank and file members of the Defence Forces, and they said that this has gone down like a lead balloon among the ranks. Like, people are furious. They see this as another time that the government is using and abusing the Defence Forces as cheap labour.
Alan Farrell, you're shaking your head there. This is in your constituency, of course.
Very much so.
So you'll be very aware of everything that's been going on up there and of everything that hasn't been going on up there.
Well, it has to be said, for the last few days, I understand over the long weekend, according to a spokesperson for the DAA who was on RT News earlier, that the queues at the airport have actually been pretty good over the weekend, which is good news. So the army have been requested by the DAA directly to Minister Ryan, who then put it to Cabinet today, and Adam is right, on a contingency basis if they're required. And as Adam has rightly said, they won't be in security positions with passengers. They might be at internal security positions, posts like that, but they won't be front facing there, and they won't be airside. Okay. If they are indeed requested, and that is only if...
If this was a really bad idea 4 weeks ago... Well, why is it a good idea now?
So I watched and participated in the Oireachtas Committee, Transport Committee debate, which is chaired by my colleague Kieran O'Donnell. And repeatedly that question was asked legitimately by members of the committee and non-members as to whether the army would be called in. It was put not just by the likes of Michael O'Leary, but by quite a few people in the Oireachtas. And it was rubbished by the DAA. At the time.
And by the Taoiseach and by the Minister for Transport.
So the response that I can give to that is that the DAA have changed their mind, and I think that's of great concern. I know that the committee have today agreed in private session to call in the chair of the DAA, which is Basil Gagan, and again, Dalton Phillips, who's the outgoing CEO of the DAA to actually explain why they've dramatically changed their view.
Well, I saw Dalton Phillips just on Prime
Time. Given what they had to say last week or two, three weeks ago.
Just before we came down to studio, as I say, Dalton Phillips was on Prime Time.
Was he?
And I think he was making the points that Adam made there and that you indeed made yourself, that this is a contingency situation. They hope they won't need them, but that, you know, all over Europe, they don't want to do what's happening all over Europe to see flights being cancelled and people being left stranded.
This is the huge worry, Katie.
But isn't it quite concerning, though, that they now think that that is, we may need the army?
I go back to the decisions that the DAA made in 2020 and again and perpetuated in 2021 in relation to the redundancy package, as has been described by many as right-sizing, and they got it completely wrong.
Yeah, wrong-sizing.
And in July of last year, you have to bear in mind, it was well flagged that international travel would resume. It was flagged weeks in advance. That redundancy scheme didn't close until well after. I think it was in the third quarter of 2021. So even during the resumption of international travel, the DAA continued to right-size, which is wrong for Irish passengers who wish to travel around the world. And now they're returning to, and I asked the DAA for their transit numbers through the airport in 2022.
So they're up to
10 million.
I hear what you're saying there, and those points have been made by many, many people now in recent weeks, because God knows this has been picked over, or the entrails of this has been picked over. But, you know, given that that's the analysis of this, that the DAA were basically cost-cutting and went too far, are we going to bail them out now by offering up our
Well, they're a commercial semi-state body, so they have their own revenue stream, and therefore they will pay for it, and it has nothing to do with the tax.
Okay, I don't think it's good enough for government to just abdicate responsibility here. Didn't they sign off on the plans that were presented to them? It was obvious at the time that they were cutting too short, but also in terms of the contracts that are given to the staff even that are there now. I know some of them are on like 20 hours a week, you know, minimum contracts, 0 hour contracts, those kind of things. So in the first instance, that doesn't allow to attract staff. And in the second instance, are the workforce that are there being fully utilised in terms of knowing what hours and having an optimal rota? I think, you know, this is a last resort, but it's reflective of the shambolic management that's out there. Yeah. We came back from Washington, Paris, the Good Friday Agreement. Our luggage arrived a week later last week. That's okay, because we're going home and we can have replacement things. But for tourists coming into this country, the reputational damage that's been done, that they have to, I know ones that have to spend a whole week here without any luggage. The prices here in terms of car hire and hotels and all of that are ferocious enough, instead of then having to go out and purchase new clothes and all that, and then expecting the Defence Force again to fill in the gaps.
Gary.
It's crazy.
We had a Future Defence Forces Commission report released several months ago. A number of issues are captured in that, but one of the issues most starkly captured was the drop in morale in our defence forces. People feeling that their role is not valued in the eyes of the state. People sign up to our defence forces for a very specific reason. They want to take part in peacekeeping missions. They want to be overseas, putting themselves in harm's way for the purpose of defence. They do so given low pay, low conditions have been eroded. And now they're being asked that they may have to go up and do a job that they didn't sign up for. It's not that what they want to do. It's not where their passion lies. I mean, people work in the airport and they're very proud to do that. People working in the armed forces for a very different reason. This is going to be a kick in the stomach to people in the armed forces who are already leaving in their droves, that actually, you know what, that job that you've had a passion for, well, that's not where you're needed. You're needed as an auxiliary staff up in the airport to help people go on holidays.
Yeah, and that is what people have been telling you, Adam, isn't it?
That's exactly what I've been hearing today. And I think one of the important things about this situation with the DAA is it raises a big question about the role of our defence forces.
Completely.
Because we've seen so many reports over the past while that our defence forces aren't equipped to defend the country. And yet, every time something happens in the country, there's a big controversy. Politicians are out, whether it's rhododendrons in Kerry or antisocial behaviour in Limerick. They want the Defence Forces called in as this last minute stopgap. But really, the Defence Forces are there to protect the country. And yet here we are sending them possibly in the next couple of months for 100 soldiers to go to the airport.
I appreciate it's being presented as a contingency, but even that contingency, the fact that it's a contingency, this is even being floated as an idea, is an offence to people who want to serve, who want to protect the country.
I'll tell you what crossed my mind when you hear it, and I'm sure this is what went across the minds of many, many people who are planning to fly out of Dublin Airport over the next couple of months, is what are they expecting here? Like, how bad can this get? If we, if a month ago it was that bad and we were saying, don't be ridiculous, we're not going to, this is not a situation where we call in the army, and we are now at a situation where we're saying, actually, do you know what? Let's train them up just in case.
Well, my understanding, again, from an RTÉ bulletin earlier, I think it was Graham McQueen, there was 50,000 people per day went through the airport Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So 200,000. And I understand, I'm just recalling from the moment I was watching that it was around about 92-93% of people got through within 45 minutes. So clearly this weekend was not the utter debacle that was a couple of months ago. And with some fortune, I think we will get through.
But you know, even when you hear the cues of the, you know, we're getting them through.
There's hundreds of people,
minutes.
Katie. Yes. Sorry, it must be said. No, there's hundreds of people going through the training process at the moment. Thousands of people applied for those jobs.
But what we know is that some of the bigger issues are having. We know that the airlines are having massive issues themselves, yes. And we know that even on days when they're getting the security cues moving, the baggage handling has been atrocious and people are waiting hours and hours for
the DAA referenced that and said that the baggage handling is actually the responsibility of the airlines, but I do understand that they have other firms looking after it, but I don't know the intricacies of airport management.
One of the key reasons the DAA have asked for the Army's assistance here is as a precautionary measure with COVID. They say a lot of the staff now are out sick and they see this kind of summer increase coming with the COVID cases and they're worried, and that's why they're bringing them, the Defence Force, in as a precautionary in case they get a lot of COVID outbreaks. And then,
funny you should mention COVID because we'll just go to that briefly. I just want to give you a sense. We've got a couple of tweets in here. Dalton Phillips and the DAA want the army to do the grunt work. Kelsa Priest, says Jerry in Limerick. And Mike says, if the army is to be used as a stopgap for DAA failures, why can't the army be used as a standby for building houses later on? And I'm sure there's people in the army thinking we're only a hair's breadth away from being called out to lay bricks here. Just on the masks, though, because we know Cabinet, they explain actually, Adam, exactly what was agreed at Cabinet today in relation to face masks.
So this actually, it started last week. The Cabinet were having a discussion about the preparing for COVID this winter, and they asked Minister Donnelly to put together a contingency plan when it comes to masks, some sort of brief legislation that could be introduced very quickly. So the Minister brought that to Cabinet today, and it's this the contingency COVID-19 public health bill. So basically what this is, he will be able to bring in a mask mandate for specific areas if the future CMO decides that it's needed. So for example, if the CMO says there's a lot of transmission on public transport, they will be able to introduce a mask mandate. Now this, it was the first time it was mentioned today, and what we're told after Cabinet was that it's not going to be any time over the summer. It's likely going to start making moves through the Dáil in September and with an eye for Christmas.
Christmas is what we're thinking about now. Horrifically. I mean, again, we're mad for the contingencies today.
I think it's the right thing to do.
Should we not be doing it earlier?
There were those in the Health Committee and in the Oireachtas at large who did argue that when the mandate lapsed, when the legislation lapsed earlier this year, that some form of measure could be introduced that if a certain scenario arose where public health doctors felt that it was appropriate for masks to be worn in certain settings, like, for instance, hospitals. There's no mandate there right now at the moment. And the point is that if the medical profession deem it appropriate, well, then it is appropriate. And therefore, we have to back it up with legislation. So I think it's the right thing to do.
Is there concerns around Leinster House now that you may have to introduce a mask mandate sooner than Christmas?
Well, we had a parliamentary party meeting, a very extensive parliamentary party meeting today, but we didn't actually discuss it because it was primarily focused on what's coming up in the budget.
There's a lot of COVID in the community right
now. But tomorrow we will have no doubt be discussing this because it is a concern. You know, we're not able to access the information as we once were in terms of numbers, and maybe that's for the right reason. But that being said, my understanding is the numbers are quite high at the moment.
But if you're a vulnerable person and your only means to get to work right now is on public transport. Yeah. It must be quite scary for
you. And that's why, I mean, I travel by train most days, and you know, most days there's a good half the passengers on the DART or the diesel in Malahide going out to the city centre that actually do wear masks. Well, maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but a good portion.
You're on different public transport than the one I'm on, I have to say. Well, I see very few masks.
I'm rarely on intercity or DART or anything like that, but I have to, intercity trains or buses. But I have to say, I mean, it is prudent to actually take the step. And that's why I think it's the right decision.
But would it not be prudent for the government to mandate it in certain circumstances?
Well, no, because government don't mandate these things, Katie. It's a medical decision that is endorsed by government. And I think that's the right thing to do. We've done that for 2 years. I don't think we should be changing it just because of, a political view or a particular viewpoint. I think it should be done on a medical basis and a medical basis only.
But given that we've got this like hiatus right now between, you know, our CMO is about to leave, we're waiting for the new NEFA to kind of get up and running.
I doubt very much if...
Are people going to fall through the cracks? And this, we know we are. Are we not? Are we not? Is it not accepted? We are in another wave now.
It is a concern. Obviously, it's a concern for everybody. It was mostly a concern for the hospitals and the capacity within the hospitals and those working on the front line.
And the nurses have asked us. The INMO have asked us to reintroduce a public transport mass mandate, have they not?
But I think, as Alan says, like we have to follow, we have to follow the public health advice, because if we start making up this as we go along, then we are just not going to do what we need to do. But I think people need to be reminded again that the current advice is to wear masks on public transport and in crowded settings. And I think more people are doing that, maybe not enough, but also we haven't done enough in terms of ventilation. We've had this time and we need to be using all this time to focus on the other measures, and also people to get their vaccines up to date and to have a rollout again for the winter in terms of, along with the flu jabs, you know. So all of those mitigating measures, I think, need to be looked at.
The public advice may very well be to wear a mask in public transport, but in the absence of a mandate, a person going onto the bus, going onto the train, who may themselves be wearing a mask, is still at a risk from the fact that most people on the train aren't. We do need to be quicker about this. I don't want to play politics with it. Let's follow the public health advice, but if we have to do it, let's do it.
But we came from a period where we had regular interaction between the NEFIT and the CMOs and government, and it was knitted into the system. But that's all lifted. We've moved, you know, gone, and it hasn't been an issue. And it just feels like there's nobody actually looking at the numbers here.
And too often, but decisions that were either unpopular or even contested were said, well, that's the responsibility of NEFIT, or was passed over. I do think we also need a government stepping up and taking responsibility here and say, actually, we're the government are the ones who mandate it. The voice can be followed, but government mandated. So if that needs to happen more quickly, let's just do it.
Okay, let's just tell you what our listeners are telling us. Katie, if the government kept or reinstituted mandatory mask wearing on public transport and in retail settings, and again, we've got to think about the workers in these settings, there might not be a COVID surge. Our government is being totally irresponsible and expecting the army to mop up. It's crazy, says Anne. And who thought it would be a great idea to lift all restrictions in the middle of a pandemic? Yes, the government cannot defend their highly negligent actions. Another listener says, Katie, I took the bus from Wexford to Dublin yesterday. Two people wore masks. Two. Mm-hmm. And masks are not worn properly by a lot of people, and was observing the amount wearing them today, and very few older people are.
And there's also issues around ventilation. I mean, this far into the pandemic, we still don't have appropriate guidelines or where necessary even grants.
Yeah, what happened to that? We were being told this was being put together and drafted. Where did that go?
So there are guidelines in certain sectors available in relation to what should and shouldn't be done. But I mean, the general guidance issued by NEFIT at the time was, and I believe the Health and Safety Authority, was open window. So, I mean, in terms of the public health advice, and just to correct your texter, it was NEFIT who determined that it was appropriate to lift the mask mandate, and government followed that advice, as they have done throughout the process, with one exception in December of 2020. And I think that we can go over the coals of that one at another stage.
Well, but if you'd like to, Alan, I'd be quite happy to facilitate you.
The books that will be written about the pandemic in the future will undoubtedly highlight it. But, you know, I do think that ultimately we have a responsibility to follow the medical advice throughout this process.
Masks are mandatory in hospitals.
I'm not trying to shirk doctor surgeries.
You won't be allowed in without a mask. Right. I was surprised when I heard you say that. I stand corrected. Sorry, I'm referring
to public places, shopping centres, things like that.
There's also standards. I mean,
I was referring to
2.5
protecting hospitals so that they don't get surges.
What's the almost 2.5 years into the pandemic, we still don't have any kind of, we're in no better place when it comes to mitigation in terms of ventilation or even testing and tracing. We don't know what strands of the disease are here otherwise.
But again, we do. So again, you're making a political point, Gary, about a medical decision. And again, I go back to the medical decisions that are made that mandate.
But these are political decisions, are they not? There's advice and there's decisions.
Yes, of course.
And I'm not shirking. No doctor makes decisions. These are political decisions.
What I'm saying is that if a ventilation scheme or of some sort was required, it would have been recommended by NPHET. I don't recall such a scheme being recommended by NPHET. So I can stand correct on that if you recall something differently, but I don't.
I don't, but I think we've spoken about masks and ventilation, but the big, you know, win for Ireland when it comes to the pandemic was the vaccine campaign, which was huge and much better than many other countries. And a memo came before cabinet today from Minister Donnelly, which kind of highlighted the need for this autumn and winter vaccine campaign. And I think that's going to be a big challenge, because I think when you speak to people now, just, you know, anecdotally, people have had their two doses, maybe they've had their first booster, and we're still waiting on that NIAC advice on whether under 65 should get that second booster, which has been a long time coming. And I think the sooner we get that advice, the better prepared the government can be for that winter.
Yeah, and on the vaccines, and this will be a political point, Alan, one of the issues that we've been campaigning on for a long time, not just in the Social Democrats, but NGOs across the country and the world, is for the TRIPS waiver and vaccine inequity across the developed world.
Sure.
And that is where the particular government have stepped in and kind of dilute its suggestions and calls at the WHO and wherever else said, actually, we won't be implementing the TRIPS waiver. That's where we won't be safe and the people across the developed world are safe. And we will see a constant re-emergence of these trends until everybody's vaccinated. We should have been taking a bigger lead here and we haven't.
Well, I think the first and most important thing just to say in response to Adam is, and he's absolutely right. I mean, you know, critically on this occasion, supply isn't an issue, thankfully. We have a sufficient supply. Now it's about getting NIAC to actually go out and make a decision in relation
to
certain.
Well, I think it's more about persuading people that they actually need another vaccine right now, isn't it?
Not to go back to masks, but there's actually a pretty good campaign right now talking about vulnerable people in certain settings, like on buses and things like that. You know, we've proven time and time again, particularly in terms of the decisions that are made within the Department of Health and the HSE, that they when they make those decisions based on the medical advice, that they implement them and they did it well. Clearly, we need to make sure that if a decision is made, that we implement it as quickly as possible. But to go back to Gary's point about the TRIPS waiver, to a certain extent, I agree with them. And you look at the logic of it. When I started out in the Oireachtas 11 years ago, I was a member of AWEPA, which is the Parliamentarians for African Parliamentarians, like an interparliamentary union. And I remember speaking to them at length about TRIPS waivers for another particular drug. For a particular outbreak or something at that time. The biggest difficulty that I would observe, and people with greater knowledge of this in the NGO sector can correct me if I'm wrong, but the capacity to actually deliver and develop the drug is the problem.
Well, actually, many people in the NGO sector will absolutely dismiss that. Okay. They say that's a complete red herring.
But I think the evidence, though, that's shown by some African nations in terms of their ability to do this, if the TRIPS waiver was granted to them, is what's important rather than...
And I can tell you again that the NGOs who actually do all the work
on the
ground
would probably
the Medicines
on
Frontier and all those other NGOs that are really, really invested in this say that that is a complete...
I think the question I would ask, though, is would it hurt for Ireland to push for a TRIPS waiver? And honestly, I don't think it would.
Yeah.
Is that a double negative? So you think we should be pushing for a TRIPS waiver?
Well, I'm saying that it would hurt.
Do you think would it upset the massive pharma industries that are many of them?
I think the exception of the financial returns from Moderna, whom I believe posted a massive loss, I think everybody else in the pharmaceutical industry that was providing drugs to COVID have made massive profits. So maybe given the amount of investment that various states around the world have put in to the pandemic and to the development of various drugs, that that we should start looking at things like that more seriously.
I just have one here, and I did think this, but I was just unsure of the detail of it. But we have a tweeter here saying that the government's own expert group on ventilation, and that was the one that was run by John Wenger, I think, at the time, recommended proper ventilation, including HEPA filters, to mitigate against COVID spread. And of course, John Gregory's actually has been placed on this new, smaller NPHET, which does indicate that we are actually now moving towards taking the ventilation issue more seriously. And there's one for you, Gary Gannon. Do you now accept that the Social Democrats' advocacy of zero COVID was the wrong call?
Yeah, let me come in on that, Katie. In terms of advocating for zero COVID, Social Democrats advocate for much stronger mitigation measures. This was at a time when there was a lockdown. We didn't have vaccines. And we're talking about, so it was a very different space. We didn't have vaccines. We're in complete lockdown. And we are calling for stronger mitigation to chase the virus. So I think that was appropriate at that time. And it was of its time.
Okay. Okay, we leave that one there because I have a horrible feeling we're going to be talking about COVID again in the next while. And I want to move on to this issue. Last Saturday, Minister of State Josepha Madigan took the unusual step of publishing the names of four Dublin schools she said had the capacity to provide places for children with additional needs but were not collaborating with her department to open special class spaces. I asked her on Saturday how those schools were responding to the department.
What are they saying to the department now? What are they saying to you now?
They're not actually saying anything at the moment. They're not engaging at all. So they're just ignoring correspondence. So that's not good for us, and it's a bit of a red flag. So if we don't hear from them with, you know, I suppose a willingness to open a special class, then we will move to the Section 37A process.
OK, so that was Minister Madigan on our programme on Saturday. Now, following that, actually, while we were still on air, we got some reaction to that. And all of the four schools now, they're all DESH schools, as it happens, have absolutely rejected that. They've pointed to emails, Zoom meetings, even a site inspection in recent days. And they say that their concerns were around facilities and proper resourcing. And in response to all of that, today, Minister Madigan said this.
From my perspective, they were ignoring the import of the correspondence. The NCSE and the department assured me that there was insufficient engagement from the schools and that there wasn't going to be collaboration around opening a special class place. And if that continues, then they will be compelled to open further special class places in circumstances if they already have one, they will have to open two.
Now, I don't know where that leads. Adam, there was big reaction to what Josepha Madigan said on Saturday.
Yes, this did not go down well.
No. And I mean, she's now saying, well, I mean, what she said at the time is not engaging at all, ignoring all correspondence.
And she's since kind of, in a very cryptic way, backtracked a little bit and saying, no, they were ignoring the importance of the correspondence, which is a small difference to make. But really, in the press conference today, from the audio heard earlier on, she was defending her putting the spotlight, as she called it, on these schools and saying they weren't doing enough, they weren't forthcoming enough to open places. So she really kind of did double down and say, no, I stand by what I said.
Alan, what do you make of this?
Well, I think to not to pivot away, but to pivot to the important remarks of the NCSE and the Department of Education, who said that.
But can we just stick with the minister's remarks first and then we'll move on to what the NCSE
the same.
Is saying?
It's broadly the same import, to use the word the minister used today, in relation to there being a massive requirement for children with additional needs to receive an education in classrooms, either in a special setting or indeed in a mainstream classroom. And the important element of this is that the Department of Education, the NCSE, National Council for Special Education, has said there was insufficient engagement in relation to the process, which is why Section 37A of the Act is being talked about. Now, it should be said that this is not the first time Section 37A has been used. It's actually the third, because there was a school in Dublin West a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, and a school in South Dublin, I think, 3 years ago as well. Now, my understanding and the note that I've been provided with indicates that the names of those schools is actually published on the Department of Education website. Now, I don't know whether that will occur on this particular occasion if Section 37 is used again for these four schools.
Okay, but Section 37 hasn't been used. I just wonder.
The entire conversation.
That's the conversation.
Is that the Section 37 takes about a year to 18 months to implement. What we're proposing is a piece of legislation that will bump that up to between 6 and 8 weeks. And that bill is called the Education Provision Perspectives.
But this is the legislation that Leo Varadkar said a week ago that there was no plans he was aware of for any special legislation. He said that last Thursday in the Dáil.
Okay, well, the Department of Education and the Minister is responsible for special education alongside the Minister for Education are publishing a bill very shortly. And the key provisions are that it'll speed up the Section 37 process, which will compel a school to provide special education.
Okay, just before I leave you, and I'll bring
children with special education. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we're talking about children not receiving
absolutely
an education.
I do, yes. We're also talking about schools who are you know, operating in some cases in quite difficult circumstances.
Absolutely.
Would you say that a school that has been engaged in emails, Zoom, had Zoom calls, even a site inspection, would you say that to say that they were ignoring all correspondence and not engaging at all, would you say that was properly representing their position?
Correspondence, communication, phone calls, Zoom calls between the department, between the NCSE, and the school is between them. So you'd have to get a department official to comment on that because I don't know. The minister has said...
But you know how English works.
I have heard...
Do you know the English language works? Is that not engaging at all?
Well, I don't know because I don't know what level of engagement took place.
But not engaging at all?
Yes, and the minister clarified that today when she said that we're ignoring the import of the correspondence.
Okay, Gary,
I can't really defend what I'm not involved in.
Okay.
The minister went on your radio show on Saturday. I can tell you, when we won your radio show on Saturday, everybody's well briefed, everybody's very well prepared. The minister went on there with a tactic to name and shame those skills and ensure that they got maximum publicity as a source of shame. She was completely wrong. She said they'd ignore correspondence, and then the skills come out the very next day and whatever to demonstrate that they'd been in constant engagement with the minister. She was wrong there. She should hold her hands up, say she got it wrong and apologise. But for the tactic of shame, when has shame in this country ever been an appropriate tactic? And how does it serve to get those 190...
Now, hang on a second. We brought this up and we discussed this in this studio last week, and every person in studio thought the minister was right to push ahead and name schools and circumstances where they were not willing to do it.
Just one second. I will be supporting the legislation that's going through on Friday. But in terms of that particular tactic last week, how does it serve the needs of getting those children?
Well, she did get the other 10 schools to engage, actually. Out of the 14 schools that were being suggested would be named, 10 engaged after it was suggested they may be named.
One of those skills that she named is in my constituency. I understand the nature of that skill. It's in a desert. They're serving a huge plethora of different needs. For those teachers who are striving to provide the best form of education, they woke up to be told that actually they're not doing their best to meet the needs of children with special education needs on Monday. That wasn't fair on them. It wasn't fair on the work they do. It wasn't fair on the children that they serve. And it certainly wasn't reflective of the correspondence that took place between that school and that department, and the minister should apologise.
Okay.
I agree with that. I think those schools have every right to be aggrieved. It's just as well they had the evidence to present, that directly contradicts what the minister is saying. You can't just they have the evidence.
They've
released it.
What you don't know that they have.
Well,
oh, they have, Alan. They have released it.
It's a matter where the department haven't responded to it.
So then, using the language while the import of something, it really isn't. This is all down to the lack of planning and foresight, and the demand that's there. It's fulfilling the rights of those children.
Rose, you're on the education committee.
There's no excuse. Alan.
The pressure that the department is under in terms of trying to provide for special education and need right across this country.
Oh my goodness.
You know, Alan, of the hundreds of places and children that have had to wait until the last minute.
And it's disgraceful that we're in this situation.
Before schools make the decision to actually go in.
I just want to refer, Rose, to the appropriate
supports
that are put in place.
And I'm going to let you back in. What are you?
Well, I just want to refer to the supports that are actually offered to schools when it comes to the provision of special educational need. And I think it's really important in the context of the discussion, because the schools are not just told you must provide it and that's that, and then a room must be set aside and teachers must be recruited and all the rest of it. It's more complex than that. So additional staff obviously are sanctioned for the new class, generally a teacher and up to 2 special needs assistants at primary, and up to 1.5 teachers at secondary with 2 special needs assistants. They're given scoping exercises with the department officials in terms of a site inspection as to what requirements might be required for the actual classroom to make it usable for children with additional needs, to make it a friendly environment for them to work, and funding for the provision of all of those things. So it's not like they're just told you must provide a classroom, away you go with it. They are actually provided with the supports necessary. Now, as I said,
now they will say, and because they're not here, I have to put this forward. They are absolutely adamant that they cannot for various reasons, pull that stuff together and have space available to September.
And I genuinely do. I understand what school pressures are under. My brother-in-law is a school principal. My sister is actually a school, a special ed coordinator. So I totally understand what is.
But is everyone being very wise after the case? Because as I say, your colleague, Kathleen Funchian, was sitting in the studio last week when this was discussed. And she said, we asked the question, should the minister go ahead and name these 14 schools? And your colleague said, absolutely, 100%.
And if there are schools that won't engage whatsoever and turn their backs on children with special needs, absolutely, yes, there must be measures there. And that's why we would support that legislation. But where you have instances where the minister is accusing schools of not engaging in a proper way when these schools obviously have, then that is not right.
And because there seems to be so much confusion on it, we have to reiterate everyone's side of it. The minister would say that there was engagement, but they were not, it wasn't positive engagement. It wasn't engagement with a view to actually opening up classes and you know, getting the resources.
Why did they say there was no need for the legislation last week, Leo Bradker, and then say this week,
because
there is.
Because compelling a school to provide a place in an area of identified need by the NCSE is what's important in this conversation. And those schools are in the area of where the identification of requirement has been made by the NCSE. And if those schools don't provide a place, Rose, by September, what do those children do? That's what emergency.
No, it's very important that it is. But why does everything have to run into this cul-de-sac situation where parents are under so much pressure? And this is happening not only in Dublin, it's happening across the country. I know children who have been sent on a 100-mile round trip out of their own community because their needs can't be met within the community. I won't say their needs, their absolute basic rights to an education. It is scandalous in this day and age. We know years in advance what the needs are in terms of educational needs of children who are born today, tomorrow and next month and next year.
Our biggest problem is actually who runs the schools. I hate to say it. I hate to go back to the origins of the Irish education system, but you kind of do, because in other countries, a primary school or secondary school gets told, within reason, of course, within the legislation, what to do. But in Ireland, the schools are not necessarily owned by the state, or some of them are. There's patrons involved who have the ultimate say on what happens, among other issues that we have to deal with.
But in that instance, with the situation we're now in, where the department is demanding that these schools produce special classes, special class places, should the patron be stepping in? Is the patron the Archbishop of Dublin, or are these within the various patron bodies? So should that be the discussion at that level?
I'm not sure. In terms of, look, what we need is that for these 109 children who won't have a place next year to have a place. We don't care who has to step in at this point to make it happen. It just has to happen. This back and forward about whether we name and shame is not going to actually ensure that those children have a place. But there is another, and I do actually also want to highlight the hypocrisy of the minister in terms of saying that they're providing for children with special education needs. 2 weeks ago, we had the SNA allocations released. It was released on the very last day that was possibly could have been released. It was released in the last minute, and it meant that principals couldn't actually plan long term. And they've been calling year on year for those SNA allocations to be released earlier. And 2 weeks ago, it was the last couple of hours of the last working day when he possibly could have. And it was the exact, and the outcome was same as last year. Go ahead.
The government has put an awful lot of effort into the provision of SNAs in my time in Leinster House. That's over 11 years now. We're upwards of 19,000 SNAs right across the education network, which is absolutely required. There's been changes to the model in recent years, which I think have improved it greatly, because there was a sluggishness to it. I can't speak to the specifics that Gary has mentioned. It didn't cross my desk, so you'll forgive me for not seeing
it. Yes, and they presented to the committee last week.
Yeah, unfortunately, I, as you probably know, my committee on climate action meets at the same time as the education committee, so I can't be at two places at once. I wish I could, because there's some really important things that happened at the education committee. But what I would say, Katie, is that, you know, there has to be a recognition of the level of investment that's gone in over the last number of years, particularly when you consider where we started with SNA allocation back in sort of 2007, 2008, I could be corrected, when it was kind of classroom assistance were a common thing, but there weren't the
level. Yes, but I think the point was, and Adam will recall this, from the SNAs were deeply unhappy that they were left hanging on until the last possible moment.
I think there is
lots. 100%, you're right. And I think Gary's right to highlight the last minute approach that this government seems to fall into, whether it's with the SNAs or with this bill here today. I mean, this bill still has to get through within the last 3 weeks of the Dáil, and so many other bills are still sitting there waiting, and important legislation. And I've spoken to some of your colleagues in the government who said they're worried that their piece of legislation is going to fall away now because they're not going to get it in before the summer. So
I think there needs to be some foresight here to see,
like, the government needs to take more of a foresight approach as opposed to this lastminute.com.
Every single year without the exception of during the COVID period, the Dáil sat a couple of extra days here and there to try and catch up with legislation or to allow members to debate important reports that might have had to be put on the long finger because of important legislation. We're sitting this Friday, for instance, two pieces of legislation starting at 9:30, finishing at 5 o'clock. And the following Friday is also allocated for as a sitting day. It's second stage, so there'll be no vote, but it is important that all the members get to have their say on some of these important pieces of legislation that are going through the House. I totally agree with you, though. I mean, it's hard to justify cramming everything into the last few weeks. It's a little bit like, you know, being back in secondary school cramming for an exam. You leave it on the long finger. I don't think it's like that. I just think there's a lot of important stuff that comes up and sometimes things get delayed. Last week, for instance, the Committee on Procedure went through the pre-legislative scrutiny process, which is a really important part of the legislative process. And it outlined that the pre-leg scrutiny process can actually take a minimum of 8 weeks. Even the waiving process, which means that the committee says, well, we're not going to pre-leg this particular piece of legislation, it's okay, that can take 3 weeks. So, you know, there's a load of things that we in the Oireachtas need to pull our socks up on, and that's probably one of them.
Do you need to pull your socks up about getting into the Oireachtas, Gary Gannon?
Not about getting into the Oireachtas. I'm into the Oireachtas. I work in the Oireachtas and Leinster House Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays every week. I don't necessarily go straight to the fob machine to ensure that I get my expenses, but I was a little bit embarrassed when I seen the headlines the other day. However,
so what are you saying? You're saying you were actually there working?
Oh, yeah,
but
completely.
You didn't fob in?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, I'm working in agriculture house, so I'd just pass by the fob machine, go upstairs, and I wouldn't even cross my mind. But okay, what you can also see if you go to kildarestreet.com, you can actually see the work that's done. So you can see if he's piping my name, you see that I'm speaking to Dáil more frequently than most other TDs. I've launched more parliamentary questions than most other TDs. But yeah, it was a bit of a kick up the backside in terms of actually just remembering the fob in. It's not, it wasn't my priority, but like actually.
It's going to become one now.
Yeah.
Didn't you have to give back some expenses before for the similar situation?
There's an inherent unfairness in what has happened to Gary, and Gary's a member of the opposition.
Why did you have to give back your expenses?
No, hang on now. It's for him to defend himself. However, at a particular point during the COVID pandemic, members of the Oireachtas were told not to fob in. We were actually told not to fob in, even though we were in the building. So there because that was the advice that was given to us. I have no idea why. I remember one of the fob machines, there's about three in the building, was actually taped over.
For COVID?
For whatever reason, we were told not to fob
infection
in.
Infection reasons?
I happened to be one of the members who ignored that mostly. And when it came to the scenario that Gary found himself in, and undoubtedly others, I actually reconciled because I was the chair of the Dáil at the time. I'm a temporary chair on behalf of the Count Corla. So I know when I'm there because it's in my diary, and I was able to go back and just say, well, I was then the chair for those things. But yes, to go back to your other point, there were expenses that I incurred legitimately in relation to computer services that I claimed in a different year, 2 months apart. But according to the forensic accounting audit, I should say, that was done, I wasn't allowed claim, even though it was a perfectly legitimate claim. I wasn't allowed claim
in the same
because
year.
One was December 31st and the other was January 1st.
So you get back the money.
So I gave it back. Yes.
Anything you want to declare now before we go to the break?
Nothing to declare. But Katie, just in terms of legislation and how things run, I mean, to the forefront of my mind is the parents of the children who want to know that they have places. Come September. It's only a number of weeks ago, and I think that's the important issue here and why we have run into this this dead end again, you know, with this there needs to be proper
but
planning.
Sinn Féin is going to facilitate
we're
this
going
legislation.
To, yeah, we were putting forward legislation anyway around the length of time.
Should be said, Katie, just to kind of update anybody listening to this, the number of children who are currently awaiting a placement in a special class has actually been reduced to around 56. And the balance of those.
This is after the 10 schools were brought on board.
So there actually has been pretty good progress made. And as you highlighted, it was actually at the general conversation about schools not taking children with special ed requirements into their school buildings that has led to this issue in the first place. Shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is.
Okay, we'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Sinn Féin President Mary Lou MacDonald has said that the government is choosing to leave struggling households in the lurch this summer with its refusal to introduce an emergency budget. The Sinn Féin leader said the government is now projected to take in 5.6 billion euro more in tax revenue this year than had been expected on budget day, and therefore there is room for public finances in the public finances for action. Earlier, Taoiseach Micheál Martin accused Sinn Féin of taking the focus off the real crisis, the real cause of the inflation crisis.
Your motion, and I quote, condemns the hardship, anxiety and desperation being felt by households across the country as a direct result of the government's refusal to introduce measures. That's what your motion says, to support workers and families. You know that's not true. People are feeling anxiety and pressure correctly because of Putin's war. There's no come on about it. You need to call this out consistently. And not for electoral and political reasons, replace Putin with the Irish government, because that's what you're doing. And you may not want to do it, but that is what you are doing, because your motion says that. You ignore the 2.4 billion in measures that we've allocated already.
So basically, do you want to respond to that, Rose?
Well, basically what he's saying is that, you know, what are people complaining about? He's done everything that he can do. We don't believe that everything is done that can be done. It's the first job of any government to protect its citizens. And if it's Irish citizens and citizens, people living here need protecting. They absolutely need protecting now. And, you know, if you look, even look across the water, look at Britain, they've had three emergency budgets, possibly a fourth one in a year. We haven't. And it's almost become, as I said, a badge of honour for the government to kind of hold fast. And people are suffering right now. I don't think we should be waiting until winter, and we don't think we should wait. We think there's a number of measures that could be brought in now to work towards protecting people, including cash payments, but also increasing the minimum wage, establishing the discretionary fund and all that. I really don't think 3 months is a long time for people in the situation that they're in now.
Okay. Alan Farrell, so after 2.4 billion... as we keep hearing, I've heard about it now ad nauseum in the last couple of months. Sinn Féin is doing a pretty good job of painting Fine Gael as the villains of the piece here, heartless.
Well, I think yet again, Sinn Féin used their weekly slot in a shameless act of populism. Everybody knows that we're in the midst of a very difficult period, both in terms of rising cost of living, fuel costs, among other things, and also difficulties in trade in terms of Brexit and impacts that has had. If you strip everything out, that is affecting us as well. But look, the first response of government and the outbreak of war shortly thereafter was to introduce a 1.4 billion euro package, and that's on top of the billion euro that kicked in January 1st in relation to budget.
I'm going to
22.
Start a drinking game.
Excellent.
And everybody gets to have a shot.
Can I participate?
Every time we hear
excellent
the 2.5 billion
but the point,
referred
but the point,
to again.
The point I would make in direct response to Rose's comments. So Rose has said that Fine Gael or the government are not doing enough. Well, the government have implemented 2.5 billion euros worth of measures.
Shot
really
for everyone.
Important. The increased social welfare payments, the increase... supports in terms of public transport,
okay,
the reduction in the fuel costs.
What she also highlighted,
I thought was really interesting, was a hardship fund of, I have it here, 15 million euro. Government actually have a hardship fund of 45.75 million euro that's already in place. So I think Sinn Féin need to go and do their homework.
But the other point
I would make is that, you know, some of the measures that we've actually introduced are very significant. Like, for instance, the fuel allowance for mostly older folk has gone from just under 800 euros to just over 1100 euros in less than 2 years. And I think it's really important for us to highlight that in the coming budget, more will be done in relation to fuel costs.
That's been eaten up by the cost of living.
Okay,
I think it's also important to say that people on a fixed social welfare income, such as pensions, such as one-parent families, have had a 5 euro increase over the last 3 years. That's been absolutely consumed by the increases in cost of living.
Yes.
So it's unfair to say, St. Vincent de Paul 4 months ago had a report saying the cost of survival, highlighting that people in one period and families are choosing not to eat on some days of the week so their children can. The charity alone had a report saying that all the people are choosing between heating their home and eating. These are dire situations. And while I don't want to play politics with it, what's coming across cruel and maybe out of touch is the fact they're saying, well, actually, we understand you're suffering, but you may have to wait till October.
No, no.
And that's if we actually bring in the measures in October,
no,
maybe
actually,
you won't have to wait
very,
for them.
For the very same reason that those charities have highlighted really difficult sets of circumstances in which the state is trying its best to assist, but is unable to do so. We've already talked about the fact that the state can't go pursuing trying to keep up with inflation, because that has a very negative
impact.
But what we can do,
intervention.
Oh, absolutely,
won't
I agree with you.
Inflation.
And if you even look at the public service pay deal, for instance, the minister said in the Dáil a couple of weeks ago that targeted measures in terms of the lower income brackets right across the country is really, really important.
Can I just say, Fine Gael increased
the minimum wage eight times over the last 11 years. And we've also proposed the introduction of a living wage over the next 3 years, bringing this up to 12 euros.
What about the suggestion?
Based on median income as opposed to the actual living wage.
What about the suggestion that the reason that you're holding out, you're holding the line, and when I say holding the line, actually, I should ask Adam about this. Every time the door gets slammed shut, it seems that Leo Varadkar comes along and nudges it open just a teensy bit again. Oh, maybe, if there was a massive fuel.
At the start of this programme, Katie, we talked about what's prudent for government to do in relation to the mask mandate. It's actually prudent for Leo to say that, because it's important for us to recognise that we're not in control of our own inflationary cycle. Somebody else is. I'll give you an example.
Sorry,
what happens at Christmas if Putin switches off the gas to Eastern Europe? What happens to European fuel prices then? And those are real and tangible things that could have an impact. So I don't think you can ever rule out bringing in emergency measures to support people. I wouldn't call it an emergency budget, because we didn't call the measures that we brought in for 1.4 billion euros in February and March of this year an emergency budget.
Okay.
But just prudent steps by government.
Okay, but the ESRI, we have the money there. It's not like the money isn't there. The central bank, the ESRI, the Fiscal Advisory Council, all very conservative organisations, and we need targeted measures to really help people in this situation. We don't know what's going to happen in December and beyond, but we know what's happening right now, and we know how households and families are worried and anxious and stressful, and they're going to be buying their household goods on credit cards, many of them, again, building up huge debt, making more profit for the banks at huge interest rates there on credit card payments. So we just can't afford to wait.
OK, I'm just looking at the clock, and I just did want to get to those calls today again for another debate on the housing crisis, because we haven't had enough of them so far. The very specific thing I want to ask you about, Adam, is that plan to build modular housing for Ukrainian refugees.
Yes, so this was a memo that came from Rodrigo Gorman today, who was kind of leading the government's charge, I suppose, on the Ukrainian crisis. And so the memo that came today was for 500 modular units. These would be built in a factory elsewhere, and then they would be moved to a site and built very quickly and supposedly very cheaply. And so the thing about this memo was it didn't have any details on how much this was going to cost, or had they got a site picked out for
it. Now, there was, I just saw that a couple of weeks ago, back on the 13th of June, there was talk that the OPW had been looking at 8 different sites for these 500 modular homes,
and
that they
OPW
had identified those sites.
It's the OPW that are leading out on this one. And I think one of the interesting things that was part of the memo today was that these homes have a 60-year lifespan. So these will be able to be used again, is the OPW's idea, elsewhere. Now, whether it's for social housing or what they repurpose the homes as, but this is kind of a long-term buy.
But isn't this an issue, though? Because the last time we tried to put in place modular homes, there was planning issues.
There were, and I think that the provision of these particular homes, it's really only at a cabinet level yet, so it hasn't really been debated. I had to go off and ask various people for it, and ultimately came back to one of your journalists who tweeted it earlier. I'm sure Adam probably did the same. So we know that they are suitable for habitation. They're A2 rated, which is an extremely well-constructed dwelling. They're going to be located all over the country.
Are they, though? Rather than specific location. Because, as I say, we had issues with people objecting to having them near them.
I can only tell you what I've been informed, and that is that they'd be dotted all over the country, that if they are successful as an interim measure before permanent housing can be delivered, then it more would be ruled out. To be fair, we've been talking about modular housing for quite some time, and the issues that you highlight are really important in the context of figuring out whether they will work.
And also, the last time it was suggested, we were told, again by your party leader, that the last time we thought they were going to be the be-all and end-all, they didn't work out too well.
All I can say is this has come from Minister Roderick O'Gorman, so this is clearly a response to the Ukrainian war, and therefore it is primarily to be used for those purposes. But if they're going to last 60 years, clearly the war in Ukraine is not going to last that amount of time. We hope. And therefore it can be used for other purposes.
Indeed. Very quickly, Gary.
Yeah, I remember seeing a presentation of modular homes down on an East Wall site in 2014, and that never materialised. Look, I'm tired of hearing about plans for the future. I'd actually like to see them go into fruition.
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah, okay, we've long argued for the high quality, lower cost and lower carbon building technologies. So I would welcome this. I do think it's a solution, but we also need to look at the local authorities, all the red tape around there. We need to look at the 60,000 holiday homes. You know, why are they? If there was only a small percentage of those put into use for people, so it cannot be taken in isolation, but.
In the next 30 seconds, as I asked in the intro there, is there anything to be said for another dull debate on housing?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. Scrutinise the minister's performance every day if needed on this issue.
I think what built on the Rebuilding Ireland plan from back in 2015 and 2016 was the all-party committee, because no party has a moratorium on good ideas. Yep. So therefore, I totally agree that if you're going to have a debate, have it in the housing committee, of course, which is the appropriate setting. My understanding is they do it every single week, multiple times a week. But that being said, if they want to bring it into the chambers, why not?
But this government seems to have a monopoly on bad ideas and bad ideas in relation to housing.
Okay, that's all we have time for this evening. I want to thank my panel. I want to thank you all for listening and for engaging with your texts. Sean Maron was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Andrew Fleming. Lee Mullen was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Carl Murray's on the way with Late Date. But first, I'll hand you over to Paul O'Neill on the Sports Desk.